This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, Bernie Sanders was right. Obamacare isn't going to cut it if we want to create a just healthcare system in America. In our People's Bulletin, we discuss one major private health insurer's move that looks set to screw over hundreds of thousands of Americans.
And we cut to the heart of Donald Trump's rapidly dwindling appeal with the week's national correspondent, Ryan Cooper.
And finally, Hillary Clinton unveiled her transition team. And if you've been paying attention to her rightward march since the primaries, then you probably won't be too surprised that the transition team sucks.
Yeah, that about sums it up, I'd say. But let's start today's show with this. We have word here that the Trump campaign is still hitting up foreign lawmakers for campaign contributions, even though it is, of course, against the law to accept or even solicit foreign donations. Australian Member of Parliament Terry Butler told The Hill that she received the fundraising email from the Trump campaign on August 14th, just a few days ago. It asked the email asked Butler to donate and become an executive member of the Trump campaign. Whatever the hell that means. Not sure what the executive member perks are at the Trump campaign. Maybe unlimited Trump steaks. Not a bad gig. They still exist. Actually, I don't know if they exist anymore.
Honorary degree at Trump University.
Oh, there it is. Finally, something that won't help you do a damn thing, actually. Anyways, Butler and other overseas lawmakers have, of course, received similar solicitations from the Trump campaign going all the way back to June. And each one of these solicitations are against the law. In fact, all these emails going to foreign nationals from the Trump campaign requesting campaign contributions prompted election watchdog groups like Democracy 21 and the Campaign Legal Center to file a complaint with the Federal Elections Commission at the end of June, saying, hey, Trump is breaking the law. You should probably open an investigation into this. Well, the emails from the Trump campaign to Australia and to the UK and to other foreign nationals continued. So these campaign watchdog groups took the matter to the Department of Justice last month. They filed a complaint with the DOJ saying, look, Trump is blatantly breaking the law here. Perhaps you should open an investigation. And as we're now learning from what MP Terry Butler had to say, the illegal fundraising emails continue to flow out of the Trump campaign. So either one of two things are going on here. Trump is, you know, his campaign just completely doesn't give a damn about federal election law. And it's just willfully breaking the law again and again. And there is actually some evidence to support that. So that's one explanation here. The other explanation is that Trump is running a pretty shoddy campaign operation and that he can't even make sure whether or not his mailing lists are in compliance. And there's evidence to support that conclusion as well. Of course, there's a third explanation here, one offered by the Trump campaign itself in a statement to The Hill, and that is that this is all the work of scammers. People be scamming. Trump campaign official said, quote, we routinely check for foreign nationals, referring to their mailing lists. Quote, however, we've seen sometimes that scammers will continue to try to add them to our system. Now, no elaboration here on what the official meant by scammers. I can't quite figure it out. Are you okay over there, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah.
Any idea on what they mean by scammers?
Just hit my knee because on the table here, because one idea came rushing to me, which is, you remember how in high school you would, or maybe not you, but people would like sign up other people for porn websites and email lists? So they would
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, it was a prank that people would play in high school on other people. Not me, though. Never. I never played it, nor was it played on me.
Okay. So,
but anyway, even if that's the case, it doesn't make the Trump campaign look good. I'm not sure why they would so readily admit that their digital team is being run by the most incompetent people on the planet. It's not terribly hard to weed out of a database email addresses that end with foreign government domain names, and all Australian MPs' email addresses end .aph.gov.au.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be pretty easy to find out which people live in the U.S. that you can solicit money from and which have foreign government email addresses. Apparently that's too much for the Trump campaign. Fred Werthemeyer, he's the president of Democracy 21, one of the groups that filed a complaint with the FEC and the Department of Justice, said that Trump is doing something that he hasn't seen in the 40 years since Werthemeyer has been covering election finance. Quote, "There is no ambiguity about the fact that these solicitations are illegal," Werthemeyer said. Quote, "It's inexplicable and impossible to understand why the Trump campaign appears to still be illegally soliciting foreign donations after they have been put on notice numerous times that this is illegal." So again, either the Trump campaign doesn't care about the law, or doesn't have the know-how or the organization to comply with the law, or it's scammers. I will say, though, there's evidence to suggest that Trump doesn't really care about the law. Here is one of the many, 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 many times that Trump bragged about engaging in corruption with elected officials.
"You explained away those donations, saying you did that to get business-related favors. And you said recently, quote, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do.
You better believe it. I will tell you that our system is broken. I give to many people. Before this, before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me."
They're there for him. Now, all that is technically against the law. You know, that's corruption. Giving donations and seeking favors in return, claiming that that happened, is against the law. But Trump has been given cover for saying things that could be construed as legal, since he has a history of spewing so much BS, no one can tell if he's serious or not. So will anything come of this latest round of disregard for the law? Well, The Hill contacted the FEC and the Department of Justice on Monday for the status of any investigations. Spokesperson for the FEC said, quote, "To protect the interests of those involved in a complaint, the law requires that any commission action on an enforcement matter be kept strictly confidential until the case is resolved." So stay tuned with that. Meanwhile, let's talk about this issue of foreign money in our elections. The FEC rule is there to prevent wealthy Chinese or Saudi or Russian or whatever individuals from buying political candidates of their choice. Well, Trump's illegal solicitations aside, an investigation by The Intercept has revealed that overseas interests have already managed to finance U.S. politics, thanks to the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010, or at least a decision that made that a lot easier. Reading from The Intercept's report here, quote, "The Intercept has determined that a corporation owned by a Chinese couple made a major donation to Jeb Bush's super PAC, Right to Rise USA. And it did so after receiving detailed advice from Charlie Spies, arguably the most important Republican campaign finance lawyer in American politics."
If only campaign finance lawyers could also tell you or could warn you about wasting your money.
Yes, certainly any contribution to Jeb Bush's super PAC was a waste of money. So here's the advice that Mr. Spies gave this Chinese couple. Basically, the law is clear. Foreign nationals can't make contributions to campaigns. They can't even donate to super PACs, which aren't supposed to coordinate with official campaigns. Wink, wink. But a company that was incorporated in the U.S., even if its subsidiary is a foreign corporation and has foreign owners, is not considered a foreign entity. Got that? As long as the business was incorporated in the U.S., it's good to make contributions regardless of who its owners are. And the 2010 Citizens United decision now allows these corporations to spend as much as they want, really, all the money they want, in our elections. Now, all of this was detailed in a memo found by The Intercept, written by the treasurer and general counsel of Jeb Bush's Right to Rise super PAC, Mr. Charlie Spies. It was written for this wealthy Chinese couple that owned the Californian subsidiary, American Pacific International Capital, and this couple wanted to donate to help Jeb Bush win the GOP primary. Now, there is a stipulation, one that Mr. Spies noted in his memo, and that is that foreign owners are not supposed to have anything to do with the American subsidiary company's political donation decisions. In other words, they can't direct that subsidiary to spend this money on a political campaign. But, you know, that's the sort of wink and nod thing, in the same way that super PACs aren't supposed to officially coordinate with their campaigns. And The Intercept's investigation found that the Chinese couple, Gordon Tang and Wai Don Chen, actually authorized the donation themselves, though they said that they didn't want to do anything illegal. And Spies, Charlie Spies, defended his memo, saying he wrote it, quote, to ensure compliance with the law. So what all this means is that our current laws are not strong enough right now to prevent foreign money from getting into our elections. In fact, Paul S. Ryan, deputy director of the Campaign Finance Watchdog Campaign Legal Center, told The Intercept, quote, Spies' memo is an explicit how-to guide for foreign nationals to get money into U.S. elections through U.S.-based corporations that they own. He added that the memo proves, quote, that although Obama was attacked in public for misleading Americans about Citizens United, in private, people like Spies and others like him seemingly realized that Obama was right and set to work making his prediction a reality.
Can I just say how sorry I feel for a guy who works in progressive politics with the name Paul Ryan? Paul S. Ryan, I salute you for your bravery.
Yes. Yes, that is an unfortunate name, I suppose. Also, basically what he's referring to here is when President Obama went for his State of the Union before, you know, the joint session of Congress and the Supreme Court justices, and he criticized the Citizens United decision and said that this will lead to foreign money going into our elections, to which Samuel Alito was like,
yeah, he shook his head.
Shook his head.
Yeah, our listeners can see that, but you were shaking your head.
Alito never went to another, maybe he did go to, but I know he sat out the next few State of the Unions. Anyways, turns out the president was right here on that case. Now, there is a bit of good news here to get to. It seems like policymakers have taken notice of this gaping loophole. Federal Election Commissioner Ann Revell put out a proposal this week that calls on the FEC to rescind the permissions that it granted to U.S. subsidiaries of foreign companies to make political donations. In other words, it would ban them from making these donations in the future. Now, back in 2006, the commission granted exemptions to subsidiaries of foreign companies to finance politics. The case was actually focused on the Canadian subsidiary TransCanada. Now, by the way, TransCanada, it looks like 10 years of those donations didn't quite work out. Anyways, Revell writes in her proposal to the commission, quote, since the commission reached these conclusions, however, campaign finance law has undergone fundamental change. The Citizens United decision and its progeny in the lower federal courts have transformed the American campaign finance system by opening up new avenues for outside and corporate spending in our elections. She added that the previous advisory opinion from 2006 was no longer, quote, good law. And she even mentioned The Intercept's report to prove that the current law is insufficient, concluding that, given the significant developments in law and practice concerning the ability of foreign national corporations to exert at minimum indirect authority over the contributions and expenditures of their domestic subsidiaries, there's sufficient doubt that the assumptions that presented in the advisory opinion still remain valid today. Now, the FEC, unfortunately, is deadlocked with three Democrats, three Republicans serving on the commission. It makes it exceedingly difficult to pass any meaningful regulation on dark foreign money right now. But to sum all this up, this is all coming at a time right now when Americans are freaking out about the integrity of U.S. elections. The news media is paranoid as hell that the Russians might be influencing the election in favor of Trump, which, if they are, they're doing a pretty bad job at it, I'd say. There's fear that if not the Russians, then at least an Australian citizen named Julian Assange is trying to wound Hillary Clinton before November by releasing information that could be damaging to her campaign. There's Homeland Security Chief Jay Johnson coming out just a week ago, basically saying that the department is considering listing voting machines as critical infrastructure to enhance federal cybersecurity protections on them, you know, prevent them from being hacked by domestic or foreign actors. So there's all these concerns around our elections going on. Meanwhile, loopholes in current law allow foreign money to flow into our elections, and there's not near as much outrage or 24-hour, 7-day-a-week coverage on CNN about this. Look, there is no more corruptive influence than money, folks. And if we really care about the integrity of our elections and preventing foreign influencing, then I think we need to start by following the money, which, you know, according to this Intercept investigation, can be traced back to wealthy foreign nationals who in this case wanted to donate to Jeb Bush for some reason and his Right to Rise super PAC. So yeah, we got to follow the money, and then we have to cut off its sources through new and stronger campaign finance laws. It's just my opinion.
Yeah, it's a shame, though, for reformers that this case, this very good case, happened circling around Jeb Bush, because
yes.
The entire primary, everyone's been talking about how, you know, oh, money isn't a factor anymore. Look at Jeb Bush. That's obviously that's anomalous.
Yeah, maybe we need some of these donations to come. Maybe Trump's foreign solicitations need to actually pay off, and someone needs to give him money for us to actually care more about this issue. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, where the two Sams are still recording from Washington, D.C.
The question of what has caused the sudden and thunderous rise of Donald Trump is something that commentators are currently grappling with. It's probably something they'll be struggling with for decades to come, perhaps even longer than that if the old goon figures out a way to win this thing. But the discussion is already fairly honed. It usually focuses on two issues, race and class, and the extent to which the two have created the conditions for Trump to flourish. Many commentators, including Matt Iglesias, are arguing that no, it's not about the economy, stupid. It's about white supremacy reacting to 21st century American society. While others are not, saying that of course racism is a factor driving Trump's rise, but the economic situation for many has deteriorated in ways not seen in decades, creating the preconditions for Trump to come to the fore. Now, joining us now to argue that latter point, as I sit here and nod in agreement, is Ryan Cooper. Ryan is the national correspondent for the week right here in D.C., and he is joining us in studio today. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
In your latest article, you point out that we can't dismiss the economic factor that goes into Trump's rise, and you actually have some data to back that up. You want to break that down for us here?
The proximate thing here is polling data suggesting that as of a couple weeks ago anyway, Trump is doing about 10 points better with white people without a college degree than President Obama was doing in 2012, or in the exit polls for the actual election. So if you want to postulate that it's mainly racism, or entirely racism, actually, that is behind the rise of Trump, then it's kind of weird that President Obama, an actual black person, would be doing 10 points better among white people without a college degree than Hillary Clinton is doing. So that's kind of, I think, the most convincing evidence that, like, there's something weird going on there, and it's not just race.
So then what do you think it is about his economic message that people are appealing to, considering most everything he says is sort of written off as kind of BS or pandering? You know, what is it that he's saying that's striking these people who are flocking to him in greater numbers than they flocked to President Obama?
Yeah, I think it's not exactly that anything substantive, you know? I mean, people are pretty ignorant about policy. What it is, I think, is that Trump is just a total outsider. He has no political experience, has never been elected to anything in his life. He just flagrantly violates all the norms of, you know, elite politics. You know, he's not just a racist, he's a bald-faced racist. And that speaks to, I think, a population that is just totally disgusted with the entire political system, that kind of this social contract is breaking down for people. And it's still true that even poor white people don't have it as bad as poor black people, but they're coming down, you know, from where they used to be, whereas black people and Latinos are still coming up at least a little bit. And so that experience of social decline, I think, which is rooted in economic conditions, stagnating wages, not being able to get a house, home ownership rate has fallen by like 5 percentage points in the last couple of years, so as low as it's ever been recorded since they started the survey in 1965. All these things, you know, just suggest a society that isn't working for the people that it used to work for. And so people are turning to total demagogue.
Home ownership is it's an important point to bring up, because it's not just about having a spacious place to live, as homes tend to be larger than apartments or rentals. But when one owns a home, one's monthly housing costs, for the most part, go toward an asset, something Yes. that you will have in retirement, something that a lot of people younger won't have. There's also, I just want to say another good stat, which seems to back you up here, which I've been sharing a bunch over the past few days, which is if you look at median household income, not average, not per capita household income, but median household income has been almost on a steady decline since 2007, with a brief sort of rising between 2012 and 2013. And if you look at the graph, that's not something that we've really seen a longer term trend in at least the past 15 years.
Yeah, exactly. And to your point, you know, that median speak, there's the top that's doing okay, the middle that's sort of treading water, and then there's people at the bottom that are just kind of in free fall. You know, the bottom 10% of male earnings has fallen steadily since about 1960. And, you know, like the people who used to be, you know, more or less making it aren't making it. And to your point about homeownership, I think that's really important, because, you know, it's even more than an asset, which is true, but it's the marker of kind of bourgeois acceptability. It's like the American dream, when you have your house with a white picket fence, and then you've really made it. And we have this vast system of subsidies designed to encourage homeownership, and it's just not working at all anymore. You know, people are just locked out of that system.
Yeah.
And people who can't get there, and more importantly, for like the foreclosure crisis that happened, and the Obama administration didn't do anything about it. They sat there and watched, you know, $8 trillion in housing wealth just get destroyed, and the banks, you know, committing systematic perjury to fake up all the mortgage documents that they had lost during securitization, and they didn't do anything. And
yeah.
So that's, I think, you know, that's the roots of this disillusionment.
Now, one thing that I will say that gives me, you know, that makes me sort of sympathize more with the, you know, sort of the race only as opposed to the race class intersection is the fact that Black Lives Matter came into the fore in 2014 after the killing of Michael Brown. And we've seen racial issues, you know, we especially, you know, we've seen a grassroots movement to push back on white supremacy in the United States over the past few years. And we've seen Trump as well use this as part of a law and order message. How do you think, you know, to what extent do you think the Black Lives Matter demonstrations and the reaction to that from the right should feature in this conversation?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. I think that, you know, Trump is in some ways kind of a return to an earlier time, you know, maybe like the Jim Crow era, or even the post-Reconstruction, the Redeemers, where, you know, there are these white governments that were, you know, dedicated to disenfranchising black people and delivering economic benefits to a kind of white population, mostly to the tippy top, but also to the kind of broad mass by racist demagoguery and by like pinning down the black working class and kind of extracting the benefits, the monetary economic benefits out of those people. So, you know, I you can understand Trump without understanding race and the history of racism in this country. Like he is following some very well-worn grooves, but those grooves are also about, you know, at the economic subordination of minority populations.
And just to add to that, Trump's campaign manager Manafort even said before Trump's RNC speech that he's looking to channel Richard Nixon as the law and order candidate. And of course, Nixon in his own way brought about policies that meant that were created in the drug war and other things to keep the economic hopes of minority populations down. You mentioned Matt Iglesias in your piece and how he argues that economic anxiety can't alone explain or just really doesn't factor much at all into Trump's rise. I've heard other liberal pundits sort of make the same argument. You see them try and explain away Trump's position on trade as not being all that influential. Of course, it's easy for a pundit in Washington, D.C. or New York to not know how trade policies have affected people in other parts of the country. But I'm just curious, do you think that you see a sort of willful ignorance on the part of the liberal pundit class, including Iglesias, that doesn't want to criticize an economic system that they've largely defended under President Obama?
Yeah, I definitely that's part of it for sure, you know, because both parties created this system, you know, the Ronald Reagan social contract where your wages are stagnant, but you'll still get your purchasing power through asset price increases and increased credit. That's the basic model. And that's what broke apart in 2007. And that was both parties. That was Jimmy Carter. That was Bill Clinton. And even, you know, Obama is trying to resurrect it almost instinctively, but it's just not working. And I think that some of what, you know, Iglesias is, he does rightly say that even, you know, you should even give racist white people a decent standard of living. You know, it might take some of the wind out of these sails, and they still deserve it even if they're bad people. But, you know, I think there's a resistance to some kind of self-implication here from this, you know, movement of kind of neoliberal Democrats who, you know, participated in financial deregulation and, you know, getting rid of unions and all this sort of thing. And, you know, returning to an earlier kind of New Deal social model would mean admitting that all of that was just a disastrous mistake. And if you can just, you know, I think it's kind of attractive to just say, well, it's just Trump people being racist and there's nothing you can do about that. So, you know, hands tied.
What do you think is really the economic appeal of Trump? I know Iglesias was also arguing on Twitter that that basically Trump shouldn't have any appeal because he's not a wonk, or he didn't use those words. I'm obviously poking a little fun, but he was saying that he doesn't know anything about the economy, which, you know, largely true, but neither did people who wrecked it in 2008. I don't know. But what do you think is the appeal of Trump?
Yeah, I don't, you know, ordinary people don't understand the, you know, arcane details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership or whatever, you know, or investor state dispute settlement. I think the appeal is that Trump says that he's going to, you know, defend the interests of, you know, without saying it out loud, white people, white men, in a way that kind of used to be the foundation of national policy back, you know, back in the like 1920s or whatever. And perhaps more important, they look at Hillary Clinton and they see someone who is absolutely committed to defending the status quo and going forward with the, you know, trade deals that core out the manufacturing base, and someone who's like tight with the bankers and all the horrible people. And they just don't, you know, the signaling is much different. You look at Trump and he's just like, the whole system's corrupt, man. And that's kind of good enough for some people, because it's like, well, at least least he's not Clinton.
Well, he also like couches it in these terms, though, that we're going to win again. So although it's corrupt, although he's running this very negative America's collapsing campaign, he does add to it this idea that might be pretty appealing to people who feel like they're losing in the economy, including a lot of white men. Like, no, get with me and we're going to win again.
And if his message, if you remember, for example, during the primary campaign of 2012, there was at one point, I believe moderators were pushing Ron Paul as to what you want to do about healthcare. Should we let people sort of just die in the streets? And some people in the crowd were cheering.
Yes.
And you know, Ron Paul gave a kind of answer like, well, it's about responsibility. It's about choice. And this primary, Donald Trump was asked about healthcare. And he said, no, of course I'm not going to let people die in the streets.
He specifically said that we can't let people die in the streets.
And first of all, I don't believe him. I think Donald Trump would let millions of people die in the streets for healthcare and health insurance related reasons.
And underneath the black boots of his.
Yeah, no, exactly. But
security forces.
But that's, we're not talking about whether or not he would do it. We're talking about, you know, his campaign, his message, et cetera, et cetera.
Before we wind up here, just a few minutes we have left, what'd you make of Trump's national security speech that he gave this week?
He is a total lunatic on foreign policy who should not be trusted to manage a laundromat, let alone the nuclear codes. But yeah, you read his speech about ISIS, and he basically says, you know, immigrants and refugees are coming to kill everyone, and everything Obama and Hillary Clinton have done is bad, and I was against it at the time, even though that involves like multiple contradictions. Like he says he was against the Iraq war, he was against the Libya intervention, and he was against pulling troops out of Iraq in 2011. He was actually in favor of all of those things. He even had a Facebook post on his own wall in 2011 saying like, we need to do something about this. So he's just a total fraud.
What do you think now that he's receiving classified briefings?
God help us all.
Might his rhetoric be moderated a bit when he's like told what the administration is actually up to right now in its fight against the Islamic State and in the stuff they're doing? Or will he just continue pretending like he wasn't informed of any of this stuff and just?
I think he's just going to keep saying whatever pops into his head. Whether or not it contradicts what the spooks are telling him or not, he's just going to just let loose.
I think that's a pretty safe bet. We're out of time here. Ryan Cooper, you can catch his awesome daily articles over at The Week, and you can follow him on Twitter at Ryan L. Cooper. Follow him. It's good stuff. More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you and still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com.
If you suddenly feel like the election is already over, I have some bad news for you. That's only because Donald Trump is blowing it. The math nerds over at 538.com have given Clinton almost a 90% chance of winning in November, up from about a 50-50 toss-up just 2.5 weeks ago. But we still have a good 12 weeks of this crap left.
Indeed we do. And Trump is doing so bad right now that there's speculation he's just trying to lose the dang thing. Michael Moore published a piece on the internet this week that he has a... And in it, Moore alleges that he's heard from sources that Trump never wanted to be president and is now experiencing an oh crap moment at the prospect that he might actually be president, so he's purposefully tanking. Moore contends that Trump was unhappy with his Apprentice TV contract at NBC, he wanted more money, and in a bid to promote his brand, decided to run for president, knowing that, of course, the Republican Party couldn't possibly nominate him. And then it turned out that he was the perfect candidate for the Republican Party to nominate.
You know, that is probably, that's the best Trump conspiracy theory that I've heard And I use the term conspiracy theory loosely. But that seems pretty spot on.
I agree with it almost all the way up until like trying to lose it. I know he doesn't want to be president. I know this was all about him building his brand, but I still can't see it in his ego to let himself lose something now that he's this far into it. But who knows? Maybe that's what's behind all this.
Wait.
Maybe it's not a mental illness. Maybe he's actually very clear-minded about what he's doing.
Well, either way, we still have 12 weeks left of Donald, at least. But that hasn't stopped Hillary Clinton from naming her transition team. The staffers, of course, that will start to implement her agenda between the election, if she wins, and inauguration. And while there are no real surprises, the team is made up of Democratic Party loyalists and Obama administration insiders, there are a few names worth mentioning. Two names that highlight Clinton's centrist credentials, despite her primary claims of being progressive. First, there's Neera Tanden, the head of the Center for American Progress. You might remember Neera from her time on the DNC Platform Writing Committee, where she and other Clinton campaign appointees on the panel fought with their counterparts nominated by the Bernie Sanders Committee. Tanden and co. fought to keep lefty planks out of the platform, including opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, a moratorium on fracking, and calls to end Israel's occupation of Palestine. The committee, with the Tanden-Clinton bloc voting no, also rejected a carbon tax, provisions supporting single-payer health care, and a $15 minimum wage tied to inflation. It instead opted for a $15 minimum wage that isn't tied to inflation.
That's just so damn progressive right there. I mean, say what you want about Neera Tanden, just don't ever call her a scumbag, because she and her allies online will work to get you fired.
Of course, that is a reference to Tanden's public feud with Matt Brunig, and also just other things Tanden says on Twitter. She's honestly really one of the dumbest persons in Washington. You just have to follow her, like some of the stuff she says on 2 days.
Yeah, come get us. Come try and get us fired.
Just for that. So anyway, the second name that's worth mentioning is Ken Salazar, Obama's Secretary of the Interior during his first term, and as Politico noted on Tuesday, a major supporter of the TPP. Salazar has worked for a law firm that lobbied vigorously on the issue as recently as this year in the spring. The TPP promotes and rewards American firms that export our clean energy ingenuity, creating good jobs at home while shaping a renewable energy future abroad, is what Salazar wrote in November about the TPP in a USA Today op-ed. Now, Clinton, of course, opposes the TPP, or at least she has claimed to, since just before the start of the primary in October, despite having previously supported the trade agreement as Secretary of State. She once called it the gold standard of trade deals as the Obama administration's top envoy. So while these appointments, again, are not exactly surprising, they are one of many reminders that Hillary Clinton will almost certainly not be the progressive president. And they are also one of many reminders that she might not even be able to keep her promises on TPP.
Well, she's got to appeal to the center and those conservatives now that she's up a projected 150 points in the electoral college map over Trump here. Anyways, for this next story, we need to reassemble in a classified session.
We need to get into classified session.
Okay, right away, Mr. Secretary. Here we are. Let's talk Gitmo. This week, in what was the single largest prisoner transfer out of the prison under President Obama's watch, 15 Guantanamo Bay detainees were sent to the United Arab Emirates. Now, 12 of them were Yemeni nationals. Three were Afghan. Of course, congressional law right now prohibits any transfers to Yemen or Afghanistan. Anyways, the detainees ranged in age from 33 to 66 years old, and most were at the prison for over a decade without facing any charges. An attorney who represented four of the detainees, David Reams, told the Miami Herald that, quote, they were never a threat to the United States and that the U.S. should never have held them. He added, quote, the U.S. took 14 of the best years of their lives away from them without cause. I am confident that they will restart their lives and put Guantanamo behind them. Well, Republican lawmakers aren't quite as confident, though. Senator Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire called the release, quote, reckless. In fact, in what appeared to be coordination, all sorts of Republicans used the word reckless to describe this latest transfer. Marco Rubio said the president's reckless release of more detainees, quote, endangers more Americans. House Homeland Security Chairman Michael McCaul said President Obama is more focused on releasing hardened terrorists than capturing new ones, a, quote, reckless policy that is putting America and the West at risk. House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Ed Royce said, once again, hardened terrorists are being released to foreign countries where they will be a threat. Too many have already died at the hands of former detainees. I fear we will be dealing with the consequences of this recklessness for years to come. Again, I don't think that's a coincidence there when every Republican lawmaker is using the word reckless in their statement. But the Trump campaign also released a statement condemning the prisoner transfer, though it didn't use the word reckless, mainly because it's probably not on the mailing list anymore. It was taken off the mailing list, doesn't get the memo from congressional Republicans. Anyways, the Trump campaign said, quote, the Clinton-Obama plan to close Gitmo and release terrorists will harm America's national security. Again, no word reckless. Anyways, Trump has promised that he will keep Gitmo open. He even floated the unconstitutional idea of throwing Americans into indefinite detention at Gitmo as well. Now, look, President Obama, if we can take his initial campaign promise at its word, would like to see Gitmo closed before he leaves office, and therefore not even allowing Trump to have the option of even keeping it open. And the numbers at Gitmo are improving for the president. There are only 61 detainees left. 20 of them have been approved for transfer and are currently awaiting to be transferred. 7 of them are facing terrorism charges and going through the military justice system there. But then there's the 34 detainees who haven't been cleared for transfer. Individuals who've been deemed a risk, but they also haven't and can't be charged with any sort of crime. So that's the sticking point, those 34 individuals, when it comes to Gitmo policy. That's why it's going to be really hard for the president in these last few months to fully close Gitmo, given the restrictions that lawmakers have placed on detainee transfers to the U.S. And also, frankly, given the president's own reluctance to use executive action to close the prison and dare Congress to sue him. If the president really wants to close Guantanamo, it's looking like this is going to be his one option to do it. And that is to say, Congress, I know you've put these restrictions, but I'm commander in chief. I can make decisions over where we store prisoners of war, and I'm closing Guantanamo. Sue me in the courts. We'll see if that happens. Now let's turn to some news for the 99%.
Full Street! High Street! Full Street! High Street! Full Street! High Street!
Hundreds of thousands of Americans this week got the news that they would have to find a new health insurance provider next year after a major industry player decided to withdraw individual plans from Obamacare exchanges across the country. Aetna, one of the largest insurers in the U.S., announced plans on Monday to stop offering the plans in 11 states, including Texas, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio, Florida, Arizona, and Georgia. The move will see insurance coverage disrupted for about 1 in 17 of the 11.1 million Americans who get their plans through Obamacare exchanges, 85% of which qualify for tax credit subsidies designed to help lower-income Americans afford health care. Now, the hundreds of thousands of customers currently on Aetna plans through Obamacare exchanges will have to get coverage offered by the company outside of the portals or through another company on the Affordable Care Act's individual exchanges. The move, however, as Bloomberg noted, quote, raises the prospect that some consumers will only have one insurer to choose from when they buy 2017 coverage.
Really missing that public option right about now that would have created more competition in that insurance marketplace.
It absolutely would have. But more importantly, as Bernie Sanders noted throughout the primary and throughout his career, it would also have changed the way we think about healthcare and the extent to which people should have to worry about finding a suitable competitor. Here he is in March 2014, making that point during a congressional hearing on universal healthcare systems in other countries.
Should all Americans, regardless of their income, have access to healthcare as a right or not? The United States is the only nation in the industrialized world that says, no, you're not entitled to health care as a result, as a right.
Now, we know that Bernie has said yes, that people, Americans, should be entitled to health care as a right. But as we see with Aetna, Obamacare's answer to that question is no. It's true that companies are less able to deny coverage under the Affordable Care Act, but you don't have a right to it. And if you're currently on an Aetna plan that's being scrapped, it might be the only one you can afford. Your best option might be a plan with worse coverage, something that's insufficient, something that will end up costing you in the long run if you end up in the hospital. Or you might end up with no plan at all, which is something that could see you penalized by the IRS at least $700 because of Obamacare's individual mandate. Under Obamacare, there is no right to health care. It's actually a mandate. It's something you're obliged to do under penalty of law. So no universal health care in America, despite President Obama's reforms. And some Aetna customers might be finding that out the hard way in the coming months.
If I could just interject here, this was the main flaw here with Obamacare, is that it created this individual mandate, but didn't create an option that they would have if the private insurers didn't come to the table or dropped out or something like that. So now we have a mandate to buy from these crummy private insurers rather than a public option that would have been another option.
No, that's true. I mean, the mandate could have been paired with a public option, and then at least...
Yeah, I remember when there were discussions on Capitol Hill, and once the public option was dropped out of the legislation, the individual mandate, I wouldn't have had a problem seeing that dropped as well, even though that kind of was the crux of the law, but the law without a public option was problematic. Anyways,
indeed,
carry on.
Indeed. So as you can imagine, the administration is none too pleased at the moment with Aetna. CEO of the Obamacare Exchange System, Kevin Counihan, blasted the company, calling its competence into question. He said, quote, "It's no surprise that companies are adapting at different rates to a market where they compete for business on cost and quality rather than by denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions." And according to the New York Times, administration officials believe Aetna might be making the move in retaliation for an antitrust lawsuit. Last month, the Justice Department sued to stop a merger between Aetna and Humana. Just a few days later, on August 2nd, Aetna said it would be reviewing its plans offered on Obamacare exchanges. One lawmaker keen on this theory is none other than Elizabeth Warren. The Massachusetts Democrat and progressive icon took to her Facebook account last week to question Aetna's motives for reconsidering what it offers through ACA individual exchanges. Aetna may not like the Justice Department's decision to challenge its merger, and it has every right to fight that decision in court, Warren said. But violating antitrust law is a legal question, not a political one. The health of the American people should not be used as bargaining chips to force the government to bend to one giant company's will. The company, Aetna, of course, has, for the record, said that the Humana merger and the ACA withdrawals are completely unrelated.
I'm sure.
Humana, however, has also itself recently said that it will cancel individual plans offered on a number of Obamacare exchanges, though the plans were roughly outlined by the company months ago in May.
Strictly a coincidence there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Anyways, time is ticking now on the show. Let's go to our Devil's Advocate segment.
I agree with you, Bart.
What about both sides?
Well, you're only technically right.
Devil's Advocate.
So as we talked about with Ryan Cooper earlier in the show, Trump is set to receive his first classified security briefing later today. Such briefings have been customary for the two major parties' presidential nominees, the states back to like the 1950s. The briefing will be conducted by career officials from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and it's expected to cover major threats and emerging concerns around the world. It will also be conducted in a secure, soundproof room known as a SCIF, which, by the way, is not too dissimilar from what we use here for our classified sessions. Actually, it's completely different. But because it's in a SCIF, this briefing, we know that Trump won't immediately spill the beans on what he's being told by live-tweeting it in real time. Trump is also reportedly bringing along some buddies for his first intelligence briefing, and one of them is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. So, clearly, it's not a good thing that Trump is receiving classified national secrets. He doesn't seem like the type that can be trusted with that sort of information. It's also a little unnerving that the guy who Trump is relying on to present to be present next to him at this briefing with him is the governor of New Jersey, who likes picking fights with teachers and stuff.
And closing down bridges.
Yeah, but hey, this is devil's advocate, so we're going to declare this whole situation a win-win. And here's one reason why this is good. Now that Trump has classified info, it increases the odds that he'll mishandle it, and thus confirming my prediction from last year that Trump's presidential bid will end with him going to jail. Actually, who am I kidding? Elites don't go to jail for mishandling classified information. So
yeah, no, they don't. But Christie and Trump might get locked in there, and then Christie won't be able to harass public school teachers. There's also, I just thought of this right now. It's off the dome, but Chris Christie looks like he's got some pretty nasty farts. So maybe he'll let one rip, and he and Trump will be incapacitated for a while inside the skiff.
Yes, render the skiff unusable for several weeks. One last one here. Christie being in the skiff with Trump shows that the New Jersey governor will likely get a top spot in a Trump administration, making him the perfect fall guy for when Trump runs into his first White House scandal, thus confirming my prediction a few years ago that Christie will ultimately end up in jail. So I was referring to Bridgegate at the time. Still counts, though. Anyways, that's going to do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.